Get away, sir.
Thank you. Thanks, folks. Thank you for joining us tonight. I imagine that most of you have joined us because your health is puzzling you, that there are reasons why you need to research it. Myself, I am now in my 59th. I am now in my 59th year, so I started to gray, and I started to need to use my reading glasses, so that must mean that I must be wise, and I must know what I'm doing. Well, as a 25-year-old, I actually entered a dentist's office as an innocent fool, and the fellow sold me on the concept that I needed to improve on natural design and have my mouth plastered with mercury. That was back in the 70s, and that really started a journey that I wished I didn't have to be on, but in the end, as always, you find some diamonds in the ashes. I essentially was forced to research this situation myself, because back then, the mainstream medical, as is still doing today, insisted that there's just no way that mercury could leach out of dental fillings and could cause any health problems. Anyway, if it were not for that, I would still be merrily practicing my computer science and management accounting. But after several years of that, I just retired into managing my own healthcare business. I wouldn't call it that, really. What I do is I work as a health coach. I started a website business. It's called Life Enthusiast Co-op. The website is life-enthusiast.com, E-N-T-H-U-S-I-A-S-T. What I want to explain to you today is biological individuality. This is something that's completely ignored by the mainstream. Why you need to know it? Think of a boat. If you have a sailboat that has no rudder, whatever direction the wind blows, it's going to blow you down the water. The biological individuality is the equivalent of the rudder, of giving you a firm spot, something that's going to resist against the winds of change, something that's going to explain it to you. To give you an example, you will hear just recently Bill Clinton was in the news with his story of turning vegetarian and healing his heart condition with the help of his advisor, who's a very successful nutritionist. And he recommends universally to everybody who he happens to see that they need to turn into a vegetarian or preferably vegan, say goodbye to all meat or high protein and high fat foods. And that's essentially the recommendation from the officialdom, from the official government policies since about the 70s. Low fat, low protein, and hallelujah. Thank you, Bill, because it worked for Bill. Fantastic. And it's great because we are able to document that this sort of approach works for certain people. But if Bill were not so lucky and he ended up in the hands of Robert Atkins, who has promoted the high-protein diet, or another recent successful person who helps a lot of people lose a lot of weight, like Jorge Cruz, he would have been told, no, no, the answer is low, low, low carb, such as maybe half an ounce at most. And with that, he would have probably gotten a terrible time. He would have probably gotten worse. And yet, if you go and visit with Jorge Cruz, he has thousands of people who have successfully managed their health, lost their weight, became very sculpted, very skinny, very balanced, and living a wonderful, healthful life. So how is that possible? How is it that what's beneficial to one person is not beneficial or is downright detrimental to another? up until about 12, 13 years ago, we really did not have an explanation. So I want to explain why that is. If you look around, you will see a lot of diabetes and obesity on one side, then you'll see cancer cases rising on another, and somewhere in the middle you have the heart disease, which, you know, when you put those three things together, you have identified about 60% of all the chronic disease that is so prevalent in the affluent industrialized society. We can actually predict with an 80% certainty that a person who lives on what we call now the SAD, Standard American Diet, whether they're going to be either diabetic or obese or get cancer. It's quite interesting. One of the researchers, his name is Harold Kristal. Harold has a business that also works from a website called bloodph.com. That's bloodph.com. Harold was a dentist and is now practicing as a nutritional specialist. I think he's in his 70s now. He was able to work his magic on the back of research done by others. Maybe I should just give you a little bit of history so you understand where this is coming from. The science of the metabolic typing is standing on the work of Roger Williams, who in 1956 published a book, Biochemical Individuality, where he showed that people are not like automobiles, that there is a huge variance in the individual parts, that every person's stomach is a little different, and every person's liver is a little different, and especially every person's metabolism is quite varied. Another scientist, William Donald Kelly, who graduated, I think, in 1960 or 61, got himself quite ill with cancer. Let me think what it was. Pancreatic cancer. And he was essentially given a death sentence and sent to go home and put his affairs in order. What followed is an experimentation. Donald Kelly was completely unafraid to try everything because he, after all, had nothing to lose. And he spent many years getting himself right. He did succeed. One of the important concepts that he introduced was large dose of pancreatic enzymes, but also understanding the metabolic type. He was working primarily with the oxidative system. There are two main systems that govern the body, the oxidative system and the endocrine system. If your dominant system is the oxidative, this is the system which generates your energy, the metabolic energy. It's also known as the autonomic system. Anyway, if you're dominant there, you would be either fast oxidizer or slow oxidizer. You may have heard those terms. A slow oxidizer is somebody who will metabolize high glycemic index foods like sugar, glucose, and potatoes slowly. So because they're digested slowly, the people can actually eat that kind of food. A fast oxidizer is a person who will metabolize these types of foods, the high glycemic index foods, so fast that it will cause essentially a sugar shock, too much hyperactivity, followed by a crash. So those are the people who need to have a diet or get on a diet that's quite high in fats and proteins in order to balance themselves. Anyway, Donald Kelly was working with this system, and because he was a certain type, he healed himself by switching to a diet that was practically vegan, eating a lot of dark green foods, grasses, wheat grass, barley grass, These are the sprouted grains, not the grains themselves. Chlorella, spirulina, and foods of that sort. And when you go online these days, you will see a lot of literature about such and such food is alkalizing and such food is acidifying. And most of these tables will work with this system, the autonomic nervous system dominance, the oxidative system, so that when they tell you that rich protein, such as, say, cooked meat, is acidifying, that would be true for somebody who's the oxidative system dominant. Anyway, William Kelly had an assistant. His name is William Wolcott. And William Wolcott took over as the director of the education department of Dr. Kelly's business. And so on the shoulders of this giant, William Wolcott was able to build a very solid body, very clear methodology. And, I need to step back. Sorry, I missed a point I wanted to make, and that was this. William Kelly, his wife became quite ill, and he was trying to heal her using the same technique that he was using for himself, which was more vegetarian, low fat. She was becoming weaker and weaker as days passed, to the point where she was unable to sit in bed, how weak she became. At that point, he was desperate enough that he was willing to try just about anything, and the only thing he has not tried was meat. So he made some beef broth and fed it to her, and she got stronger, and he fed her more, and she was able to sit up, and he was feeding her a high-protein, high-fat diet, and realized that that is what she needed. This was the great genius of Dr. Kelly, the willingness to not persist in the face of evidence. Anyway, so William Wolcott was able to discover that about half the people that Dr. Kelly tried to treat was not getting the kind of help that they expected, meaning that some people get balanced by the low-fat, high-fruit and high-vegetarian diet, but other people suffer trying to eat and live like that. And he found a book by George Watson that was published in 1972 that explained a lot. George Watson was working in the mental health field. He was helping people get clear of things like depression and the manic depressive or bipolar, it's called lately. People with mental problems. And he was able to identify that most of these people had a parasympathetic or sympathetic system dominance, the endocrine system, governing their metabolism. And again, in the sympathetic, you would use the foods that are mainly vegetarian, low-fat, low-protein, to balance the person. And if you were parasympathetic dominant, you needed to eat a fairly high protein, high fat foods to balance the person. I guess you can think of it this way. There are some genetic reasons for all of this. We start with people as hunter-gatherers, the ancient culture, the blood type O's. They were either fishermen living on the coasts, where they would be catching a lot of seafood, probably eating a lot of seaweed. If it was in warm climates, they would be eating a lot of coconut. If it was in colder climates, they would be eating a lot of codfish. So they would still have decent supply of fats. I guess an extreme example of this would be somebody like living in an igloo, an Eskimo living in a northern climate where they would be eating whale blubber and seal liver, practically all meat and all fat, and still living a reasonable, healthy, balanced life. At least their metabolism would allow them to stay functional for a long enough time. On the other side, you will have somebody promoted by Peter DeAdamo. There is a strong overlay between the people who need to eat high protein, high fat diet, and the blood type O's, and the and mostly vegan fruitarian on the blood type A's. The blood type B's are mixed. They need a mixed diet, somewhere in the middle. AB's, they are a combination of the A and B, so it gets really complex. Myself, I am an AB, so I could be a vegetarian all morning, but by the time the evening arrives, I need to look for some protein-rich foods or else suffer the consequences. So we do have a pretty solid body of evidence that tells us that this sort of thing is working. I could quote you a study done by Dr. Kristall in his clinic, 1,450 files were surveyed and analyzed, and here's what they've come up. They sort people on two types, whether you're oxidative or whether you're endocrine dominant. Two types of that require a group 1 diet. Group 1 is the people that need to eat more on the vegan vegetarian side. Group 2 is the high protein, high fat diet. So, interestingly enough, people who are in group 1 are very likely to end up with cancer, about 80% of them, and about 40% will be overweight, and about 20% will have diabetes. Whereas the people with group 2, or who should be eating in group 2 and aren't, 72% of them will get diabetes, only 20% of them will have cancer, but 60% of them will be overweight. So what you can see in rough numbers, if you're not eating a decent diet, if you're eating the standard American diet, you have about a 50-50 chance of becoming obese, regardless of which group type you are. Depending on whether you're group 1 or group 2, you have either an 80% or 20% chance of getting cancer and the opposite balance of diabetes. So that's fairly clear to tell us that the biological individuality is quite dominant in showing us what type of problems we'll have if we ignore the nutritional side of things. So I imagine you're wondering, well, heck, when is he going to tell us how to find out which type I am? Both the bloodph.com and metabolictyping.com offer tests. You can take an online test, and you can also locate a certified health practitioner who has taken the education, who is able to administer specific tests to you, if you want to go all the way to the details. Most people are able to figure it out by themselves from a questionnaire. Or even without a questionnaire, you should be able to figure out which body type you are, because, consider this, if you eat something sweet, it will either energize you and sustain you, or it will make you completely, what shall we call it? I don't want to say crazy, but hyper, and you will experience a crash after that. The opposite of that, if you ate something fairly heavy, like let's start your day with an omelet and proceed into a steak and salad, by the time lunch rolls around, you will know whether you're doing yourself a favor or whether you're completely thriving on that sort of meal. In fact, if you're experiencing health issues, let's just say that you're overweight, most likely the kind of diet that you're eating right now is contributing to that, and it would be really smart to change it. Because if you got to this place of unhealth, the only thing we know for sure is whatever you've done thus far needs to be changed. Anyway, let me describe what happens in the actual testing. The testing is done by taking a glucometer, the same device that diabetics use for checking their blood sugar level, and administering to the person a sugar challenge or glucose challenge. It's a drink that contains about 40 grams of glucose or dextrose and about 8 grams of cream of tartar, a source of potassium. And at the beginning, you have your blood glucose level checked, and then the level is checked again in 30 minutes, 45 minutes later, and 20 minutes later, and this is charted. And also your vital signs are observed, your breathing rate, your ability to hold your breath, your pulse, and also how you're feeling. If you're feeling energized from the sugar and you're able to sustain it, and if at the end of the test you're not feeling ravenously hungry, you're one of the types. If, on the other hand, you felt really energized for a short time and then crashed, and at the end of this two-hour period you're feeling just ravenously hungry, we know that you're another type. So we're able to determine quite, how should I say, with high level of certainty whether you are or are not either oxidative system dominant or the endocrine system dominant, and choose from one of the two groups, we'll be able to tell you whether you should be eating on the group 1 foods or group 2 foods. There always is some middle ground. I gave you the example of the Eskimo and perhaps the red, if I pick colors, end of the spectrum. And through the rainbow on the far side, in the violet end, we will have the vegetarians. There is a lot of space in the middle. So many people will need to fine-tune and figure out what mix works best for them. But one thing is for sure, if you find yourself at this place that you're needing help with your health, we are certain that what you've done so far is not right. So, the not right. Number one, we already know that certain foods are bad for everybody. These foods are the very high glycemic index foods, such as sugar, especially high fructose corn syrup, alcohol, which is just a more complex sugar, and starch, which is also just another complex form of sugar. So all of the refined things that are milled flour, baked goods, bread, pizza, cake, all of that, that's not healthy for anybody, period. There is nobody that should be eating that for health. Additionally, refined fats. If you go into a grocery store and pick up a bottle of oil, if it says refined vegetable oil, the word refined means that all of the omega-3s, the fragile fats, have been removed from it. It's the really fragile fats, like that they are known as the omega-3s, that your body requires for many of its processes, preventing oxidative damage. Anyway, these fats are removed because they make these oils taste rancid. So for that reason, if you find oils on a grocery store shelf in a clear bottle, unrefrigerated, they are not going to be good for you no matter what. The good fats, coconut oil, olive oil, especially virgin olive oil, and surprisingly butter, not margarine, because trans fats, hydrogenated fats, are not good for you. Anyway, those three mainstay, coconut for the tropicals, olive oil for the Mediterraneans, and butter for the further in the north, and of course fish oil for the fishermen. Those are the healthy fats that a body needs. So anyway, I was on the trying to list all the foods that are not good for you. So refined sugar, refined flour, highly processed foods, refined oils, processed salt. Strange enough, refined salt is not a good idea. You should be eating whole salt. Whole salt such as real salt or Celtic salt or Himalayan salt. Those are recommended and good. Especially for people who are eating a larger amount of protein in their diet. Sodium, I get sidetracked into many little pieces of information. The sodium potassium pump that is functioning in your body is helping the nutrients come into the cell and the metabolites or toxins to come out of the cell. There needs to be a balance between the potassium on the inside and sodium on the outside of every cell. Otherwise, the sodium pump doesn't work. So if you have too little sodium, imagine that. If you don't use enough salt, healthy salt, then the pump doesn't work well enough to remove the toxins out of your cells, and you become toxic, and toxicity leads into complications, including cancer. So I think what would be probably right at this point is to open the line for questions. And what I would like to do, I mean, in order for me to do that, I have to put everybody on, and that there are several hundred people here, so we need to try and behave. So if you have anything noisy going on, could you please tone it down? And any one of you who wants to ask a question, just go ahead, speak up. I will try and answer all of the questions that are relevant here. Before I go there, I would like to explain my perspective. I work as a health coach, helping people set themselves right on the course towards health. And in the course write-up, we put out that we'll reveal to you the three causes of illness and how to reverse them. I call them stagnation, toxicity, and malnutrition. Stagnation is probably the worst of the lot. Stagnation essentially means that there's not enough circulation in the body. It could be in the lymphatic system, which is from lack of movement, lack of exercise. It could be at the cellular level. That's a word fun to express because of the sodium-potassium pump not working correctly. The malnutrition is a classic in this affluent society. We're using foods, we're eating foods that have been grown using the industrial agricultural method on fields that have been over-fertilized but undernourished. The soils today are depleted. The plants are pushed to grow fast, but even though they look like the carrots or the broccoli, they're quite hollow in the sense that they don't contain the kind of minerals and nutrients that they should contain. We have scientific studies that show us that in the last 100 years, for instance, the level of magnesium has dropped in carrots down to 30% of the level it had 100 years ago. So anyway, malnutrition, there are many aspects to it, the mineralization, but also vitamins, enzymes. This lecture is too short to let me list all of it. And the third one, toxicity. Primary toxicity from lack of elimination and also from ingesting toxic things. We're drinking water that contains now chlorine, which is not the right thing for you to drink, that contains toxins, remnants of pharmaceutical drugs from upstream use. That's just the water. We are inhaling the exhalations from industrial plants. Just so you know, every year 50,000 tons of mercury are pushed into the air in the United States alone by burning the coal in coal-powered plants. anyway, Life Enthusiast Co-op is helping people with products. Well, first education, but secondarily with products. We make a living by making available to you high-grade, high-quality foods. These foods and supplements are fine-tuned to fit.
Can you hear me? Hello?
Yes, I hear you now.
Hi. I have a couple of questions. I was wondering if you could address alkaline water, and if you would also talk about what the experts are saying about when your body has damage, you need red meat for tissue repair. I don't agree with that, but maybe they're right. I'm wrong.
I didn't quite hear. Eating red meat when or if what?
Oh, there are some experts out there saying you need red meat for tissue repair when you've had injury to your body. And is that true?
All right, I'll talk about that. Okay, the call's muted. I don't know, some guys just ignored the request, and there was a lot of background noise. Somebody's listening to us in a bar or something like that. Anyway, the question was, what do we think of water ionizers and drinking alkaline water? And the second question was, what is the story on red meat? So, the ionizers. One of the issues with ill health is oxidative damage. From imbalance between the anions and cations, or essentially the acidic and the alkaline ions. What I didn't say at the beginning of the lecture is the following. The midline for blood is 7.365, or some books say it's 7.46. Two of the metabolic types are actually already on the alkaline side of this midpoint, and two others are on the acidic side of the midpoint. And two of these body types are alkalized by high protein, high fat, and two of these body types are acidified by high protein, high fat. So what that really tells us is that if a person is already acidic because they're eating against their body type, they need to alkalize. They could be alkalizing using the correct side of the diet. So depending on which they are, they would be eating either high protein, high fat diet, or the opposite, right? The low fat, low protein. But either way, they would be alkalizing themselves from an overly acidic state toward the midpoint. Using a water ionizer is a crutch for that. So it will work for about half the people. If you're already acidic, using an alkalizing set of minerals, such as baking soda, or drinking the alkaline water, will definitely help push you towards the middle, which is great, because the symptoms of over-acidity are unpleasant. You could be experiencing anything from obesity, to cancer, to arthritis, to fibromyalgia, to chronic fatigue. And all of these, if you're overly acidic, will respond correctly when you start drinking the alkaline water. You can also experience or attain the same sort of benefit by putting baking soda in your drinking water. But you need to be sure that you're already overly acidic, as opposed to overly alkaline. So how would you find that out? You would check your pH of your saliva first thing in the morning before drinking anything, and it should be somewhere around 7.0. If it's on the acidic side, some people are at 6 or even below 6, that definitely is an indication of acidity. And you would need to be taking the alkalizing minerals. Now, to answer about red meat, it is possible to do this metabolic typing eating as a vegetarian. There are plenty of plant-based foods, such as chlorella, spirulina, other algae, rice protein concentrate, hemp protein concentrate, that allow us to eat a high-protein diet. it is a lot easier to do that with meats. And so especially people who whose blood type is either O or B would do well on eating that sort of thing. When we say red meat, we should be saying either grass-fed beef or wild, like lamb or venison, elk and deer. It certainly should not be grain-fed cattle from the feedlots that provide us with these beautiful, sweet-tasting, acid-producing steaks. So that's the complication. Okay, one more time. We'll let you ask another question. Go ahead.
And there was the other one.
Go ahead. Okay.
What about the raw diet? Oh.
What about the raw diet?
Yeah.
Okay, Helen. Right.
Ow.
Okay, so the question from the field says, what about the raw diet? You know, raw is a wonderful thing. When you are able to eat most of the foods in their raw state, they contain the enzymes that that help to digest the food itself. And you could see that when you leave something raw, let's just say you slice an apple open, it doesn't take very long before it starts oxidizing and digesting itself. Or if you leave a piece of meat, if you left it at room temperature, it won't take very long before it starts being consumed. If, on the other hand, you leave something that's already cooked, it will sit in its cooked state a lot longer. Maybe this is not the best way to answer it. Let me try another approach. Raw food contains all of the unspoiled nutritional makeup that it is able to deliver. When we cook food, well, when we cook proteins, they coagulate, so they become less digestible. The surface gets caramelized, and it tastes better, but it's less digestible. What's interesting is that some foods, like vegetables that are, I don't know, I'll have to name them, things like onion, carrot, broccoli, parsley, and a few others, they actually yield most of their nutrition when they're slightly cooked. When you cook something either in steam or in a wok for stir fry, you will notice that the onion will start as opaque, white-looking thing, and then after a moment turn translucent. Or a carrot will go from this dull orange color into this glassy, glowing color. And similarly for broccoli, it will go from dull green into brilliant emerald. That's about the state at which you would stop cooking it and start eating it. This holds true for other things, like for instance tomato. One of its greatest benefits is the lycopene, and the lycopene doesn't get activated until you cook it down into a tomato sauce. So as far as a fully raw diet, It's helpful, it's life-supporting, and we definitely should eat at least half, preferably two-thirds, of everything that goes past our lips in raw, uncooked state. And then, with that, we should supplement or complement it with some cooked foods. Like, for instance, if you're eating carbs, maybe a bowl of rice, or a piece of protein, like a piece of chicken or whatever, if you're eating that way. The rules that we run by typically are eat the amount of concentrated food that's about the size of your hand. So in a steak, that would be about 6-7 ounce steak. If you make a fist, that would probably make about one large potato or one bowl of rice, and an unlimited amount of vegetables with it. If you can eat a gallon-sized salad, go with that. one of the best foods that you could eat is fermented, which is still raw and still living, but has all of its sugars eaten by the fermentation bacteria, the lactobacilli. There's an entire book written about this that I quite like by Donna Gates called Body Ecology Diet, where Donna explains all the benefits of fermented foods and how to prepare them. Again, we just won't have time to cover all of that, but let me say it this way. Raw food, fresh from the garden, it probably has about 97% of the nutrients that it had when it was growing. Something you buy in a grocery store that's been refrigerated for 10 days or 2 weeks probably has, 80% of the nutrients. Something that's been freeze-dried right off the field probably has more nutrient values than something that's actually on a shelf looking fresh in your grocery store. Frozen foods are able to retain a lot of the nutrient value. Canned, not so great. There still are the nutrients, such as the minerals in the food, but the enzymes are gone. These days, I just shop on the perimeters of the grocery store, leaving the center alone. There's not much there that's actually nutritionally supportive of a human existence. Okay, anybody else with a question?
Was really the sky.
Okay, anybody?
Uh-huh.
Speak up.
Well, his wife, I think, is kind of told him how to go.
Well, what about food intolerances, especially wheat?
Oh, yeah. Okay, great. I'd like to tell you this. There's a way to get hold of me if you want to after the show. We have posted a link. We have posted a link to one of our other websites, which is remarkablehealth.com/teleclass, where you can sign up for live sessions rather than these monologues, interactive sessions where you will actually get a lot of your questions answered. So you can go to www.remarkablehealth.com/teleclass. You can also reach us by phone. You can call at 1-866-543-3388. That's 866-543-3388. We're open from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. Pacific time, or 11 to 11 Eastern. Anyway, speaking of food intolerances, one of the most common food intolerances has become gluten. There are two reasons for it. One of them is that gluten is really not great for people with the blood type O, especially for them. So if you're supposed to be on a high-protein, high-fat diet, eating a high-carb is not good for you, and especially eating a gluten is even worse. The gluten grains, that would be wheat, barley, and rye are, how do I say that? There's this one particular protein in it that a damaged gut is not able to handle. I guess I'm going to have to get into a bit of a scientific explanation. It's something like this. The brush border barrier between the content of your intestine and the bloodstream is supposed to hold back anything that's underdigested. When this becomes weakened, the villi in your small intestine are shortened about the same way as the grass gets trampled on the lawn tennis court until it's practically down to bare dirt. When this brush border barrier becomes permeable, all of a sudden you have underdigested bits of protein getting past the getting into the bloodstream where they shouldn't. And all of a sudden, your body is having to try and filter them and attack them. And that's where food allergies come from. it could be an allergy to the gluten. Many people are allergic to cow's milk because there's the casein. There are two types of casein, A and B. The human is the B type, together with goats and sheep. The cow's milk has the casein A type, which a lot of people have allergies to. The second thing I wanted to mention, anyway, the answer is that's how it develops. It develops because of intestinal dysbiosis, which may have come around because of drinking chlorinated water, taking antibiotics, eating foods that are damaging to your metabolic type, taking prescription or over-the-counter drugs. There are many, many reasons why a person will develop a leaky gut. And off we go into the allergy territory. Anyway, one more. We're getting to the top of the hour, so we'll just take one more question, and we'll be closing. Go ahead.
What?
What about calorie restriction?
Okay. Yeah. Good point. Okay, is there anybody else with another question before I shut it up? Okay, so we'll answer the calorie restriction. So there's an issue with energy, with, the obvious point is this. If your intake of calories is greater than the output of the calories day to day, there always is an excess of energy. Your body has to do something with it. The insulin in your body, its main job is not to manage sugar. Its main job is to create a storage of energy. We are actually designed for a life of insecure food supply. 10 or 20,000 years ago, when our physiology was developing, or at least for the lifestyle that we're developed, we didn't get to eat every day. Things were in season for a short amount of time, or if the hunters caught something, we would have plenty of food to eat for a day, or two, or three, and then there could be a period of very little food, or hardly any food, for extended amount of time. So our physiology is designed for feast and famine. We're supposed to be able to eat, really overeat for 2 or 3 days, and then hardly eat at all for 3 or 5 days after that. Or we could have seasonal lulls where things are out of season. You know, in the fall, all the fruits and berries, in the summer you have berries, in the fall you have fruits, and other harvest in the winter, you would probably turn into hunting and try to eat off of something you killed. And come spring, you'd be eating grasses and young shoots of things. So going in full circle to the calories, your insulin, its main job is to file away, to hide away, to create stash of energy for the time of need. So if there is excess of calories, it's putting it away in the form of fat. So you get fat. The only way to deal with it is to create a balance where you eat fewer calories than what your output. Now that means that you need to eat a large amount of food that's low calorie. That the worst possible food that I can think of is something like a pizza, where you have a load of calories. I think pizza was designed for somebody like a farmer, maybe an Italian farmer at the height of harvesting, where they are working really hard, needing to eat maybe 9,000 calories a day in the quickest possible time. So if you eat pizza, you're putting it on, but if you're an office worker, that's a very bad idea. Instead, you should be eating a large amount of uncooked vegetables, either fruit salads or vegetable salads or you know, Chinese restaurants are really nice because you can eat a large stir fry with a small amount of either rice as a carb or a piece of meat as a protein. Those types of meals provide you with a large amount of food that creates a fullness in the stomach and does not load you up with calories. So that's my answer, is yes, that calorie restriction, that there's an entire field that promotes calorie restriction as a lifestyle where you intentionally undereat. And it's been shown that, for instance, mice that are fed 30% less than they would normally eat, they live about 30 or 40% longer. So that would mean in a human life, instead of being finished at 70, you'd be in same shape as your 70-year-old neighbor at the time you're about 105. So that's where the calorie restriction is very good, because it's the other point here. Calories are burnt in a fire. Metabolic fire is sort of like having to hold a hot charcoal briquette that you just picked off of a barbecue, and you're having to hold it with your bare hands. It's the type of fires that are happening inside of every cell. There's the oxidation that's oxidating the energy in order to, it's oxidating the sugars in order to create the energy that your body requires. So if there is more energy, or if there is more of the metabolic fire, it's going to cause greater oxidative damage to the body. And oxidative damage equals aging. So when you have more to eat, you're actually aging faster. When you have less to eat, you will last longer. So the moral of the story is, if you want to live longer, eat less. Okay, folks.
And then you don't have anything until December when you go see Havlick, our family doctor.
I'm sorry, I don't know. Are you talking to a neighbor there?
This is August of next year, the urologist.
Okay, we're having somebody having a conversation.
No, August of next year. Yeah.
Okay, good people. If you're talking with neighbors and whatnot, I just had to mute it because I wasn't able to speak to anyone. You can find a subscription to a newsletter that relates to this show at life-enthusiast.com/teleclass. You can find a subscription to another smaller but more personal version of this lecture at remarkablehealth.com/teleclass. And if you wish, you can give us a call at 1-866-543-3388.